Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Gay Buddhist Fellowship. Just by show of hands, is there anyone returning after a long absence or here for the first time? Great. We will try and remember your names as we go around, make you feel welcome. Our tradition is to introduce ourselves first before we introduce our speaker. My name is Tom Bruin.
My name is Oswaldo.
I'm George.
My name is Mark.
I'm Peter.
I'm David.
My name is Tom.
Larry.
Gary.
Ralph.
Gerald.
My name is Jerry.
My name is Roy.
My name is Prasada Chitta.
I'm Jerry.
My name is Jeff.
Augusta Hopkins.
My name is Peter.
I'm Kay.
My name's Evan.
My name is Michael.
Liz.
Chris. Dan.
Gray.
My name is Jeff.
I'm Wally.
Harry.
Warren.
Baruch.
Jay.
Patrick.
Adam.
Arthur.
Joe.
Nathan.
My name is Tage.
My name is Cass.
I'm Hal.
I'm Michael.
Jim.
Wonderful. So, I have the pleasure today of introducing our speaker, Bill Scheinman. Bill has been practicing meditation since 1994 and has been teaching it since 2001. He is the author of the book, Moment by Moment, Using Mindfulness to Reduce Stress and Cultivate Freedom in Daily Life. A graduate of a mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher training practicum, he teaches 8-week MBSR classes in San Francisco and Berkeley, as well as workplace courses and day-longs on mindfulness and stress reduction. He is a graduate of the Dedicated Practitioners Program at Spirit Rock Meditation Center and is a member of the board of the San Francisco Insight Meditation Community. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here again, everyone. It's always nice to be invited to share the Dharma. It's one of my favorite things. And tonight I'm going to give a talk, which is kind of a traditional Buddhist talk. And but I want to preface the talk by saying that this path that we're on, the Dharma, we don't, this isn't really a kind of typical career for most people, career option or choice for the wider culture. There's a reason that we come to the Dharma. It's usually not accidental. And we all have a story for why or how we came to the Dharma. Of course, it's possible that maybe you just were interested in meditation, or a friend brought you to a meditation and you decided to check it out. That's certainly true. But for a lot of us, I think we came to the Dharma because there's some story that happened in our lives, some experience of crisis or an experience of an illness or a loss, an experience really of suffering that brought us to the Dharma, that got us into the Dharma, that made us find this path that we're on. And I know in my life, my own life, the thing that got me into the Dharma was romantic heartbreak. And I had actually, it wasn't one romantic heartbreak, it was a romantic heartbreak that was the culmination of a series of about 15 or 16 of them over, I don't know, a 20-year period or something. And in the whole, you know, the whole course of my life, when I was going through a lot of these heartbreaks, I finally kind of got into the idea that there were some things I needed to do to learn about myself so that I wouldn't have all these heartbreaks again and again and again. And actually, for most of my life, I've been a writer, a fiction writer. I write, you know, short stories and novels, and I've been involved in the arts. And for really most of my early life, in my 20s, early 30s, I thought that art was the thing that could transform me. That's the thing that was like my personal growth, was art. And but then after this 16th heartbreak, actually before the 16th heartbreak, somewhere around heartbreak number 8, I realized I needed something more, and so I started therapy. And I worked with a therapist for a number of years, about 7 years, and I learned a lot about myself and a lot about my what happened in my childhood, my relationship with my mother, my father, a lot of good work. I did a lot of good work on myself. And really our therapy got to a point where there was really nowhere else to go, and I had really learned as much as I could within that paradigm. And then I had my 16th heartbreak. And I was really stunned. I couldn't believe it. It was actually the most devastating of all the heartbreaks, because I felt like I had learned so much about myself that there was no way that I was going to have that kind of a heartbreak again. And I ended up having even a worse one. And this was somewhere around the winter of 1993. And I knew that I needed something other than the therapy paradigm to transform myself, to transform my relationship to suffering. And I was, you know, that last heartbreak, that was just like the straw that broke the camel's back. And I just had to do something other than what I had been doing, which was therapy. I felt like I needed something else. And my heart and mind were totally open to finding something different. And somewhere around the the end of 1994, I read a book by Alan Watts called Psychotherapy East and West. And that's really a great book. It's kind of the relationship between Western psychology and Eastern spirituality, or specifically Buddhism. And it was just what I needed to read, because I had just basically completed my therapy. And I was looking for something else, and it seemed like, wow, I can't believe this. This is so interesting. Buddhism, wow. So in the spring of 1994, I took my first meditation class, actually in this building, believe it or not, upstairs. And I've been a meditator ever since. And but that's kind of how I came to the Dharma. It was just having too many heartbreaks, and to the point where it was like I couldn't go on the way I had been going on. So a lot of us have stories like this. Stories of experiencing suffering to the point where we finally decided to seek freedom. And so this morning I'd like to talk about something called the four divine messengers, or the four heavenly messengers, also known as the four sights. And this is basically the Buddha's story of how he found the Dharma. So just reflect on this for a moment. So the Buddha wasn't always the Buddha. And he had to find the Dharma, just like we found the Dharma. He was an ordinary human being. We think the Buddha, you know, this is what we see. It's a beautiful, beautiful statue of the Buddha. But we forget so often that the Buddha was this, flesh and blood and bones, just another human being. So the Buddha also had a very deep experience of suffering, of dukkha, the Buddhist word for suffering. And it was so profound, in fact, such a profound experience of dukkha, that he ended up leaving home, leaving his wife and child, leaving everything he knew. And luckily for us, he found the end of suffering. He realized the Dharma. And so because of the Buddha's experience of suffering, his profound experience of suffering, we're actually sitting here today, which is kind of amazing. You know, he had that insight, and 2,600 years later, here we are practicing the Dharma together. So, but the Buddha, as I said, was not always the Buddha. Before he was the Buddha, he was a man named Siddhartha Gautama. And Siddhartha was born into a world of wealth and privilege. He was the son of a man named Suddhodana, who was a very wealthy leader of the Shakyan clan in what would now be modern-day Nepal. And when the Siddhartha was born, it's said, this is a traditional story, that when Siddhartha was born, it's said that there was a prophecy made that he would either be a great man of, a great leader, a man of the world, a man of earthly power, or he would be a great spiritual teacher. Now, Suddhodana, his plan for his son was that he would take over the family business, as it were. And he was very happy to have an heir to take over his affairs. But it terrified him that his son might become a spiritual teacher. And so Suddhodana decided that no matter what, he would prevent his son Siddhartha from learning about anything outside of the world, outside of the estate where he lived, that would possibly throw him off or make him want to turn toward the spiritual path. And he decided to protect Siddhartha, protect his son from all the unpleasant experiences in life. He forbid him to go to the nearest town, Kapilavatthu, because he didn't want Siddhartha to see any of the roughness of the world in that town. And he basically coddled his son for years and gave him everything he wanted and really spoiled him. So years later, the Buddha himself described how he was raised by his father in kind of this environment that he was living in. And he's addressing the monks that he was with. "Monks," he said, "I lived in refinement, utmost refinement, total refinement. My father even had lotus ponds made in our palace, one where red lotuses bloomed, one where white lotuses bloomed, one where blue lotuses bloomed, all for my sake. I used no sandalwood that was not from Varanasi. Varanasi is a big city in India, and in those days it was kind of like the Beverly Hills of India. It's like all the good stuff came from there. My turban was from Varanasi, as were my tunic, my lower garments, and my outer cloak. A white sunshade was held over me day and night to protect me from cold, heat, dust, dirt, and dew. And then he goes on. I had three palaces, one for the cold season, one for the hot season, one for the rainy season. During the 4 months of the rainy season, I was entertained in the rainy season palace by minstrels without a single man among them, and I did not once come down from the palace. And he goes on, whereas the servants, workers, and retainers in other people's homes were fed meals of lentil soup and broken rice, in my father's home, the servants, workers, and retainers were fed wheat, rice, and meat. So, Siddhartha, this young man who became the Buddha, was living a really hedonistic lifestyle, was really having fun. And, but of course, all of his pleasure, all of his ecstasy, all of the protection that his father had contrived, it was a house of cards that was just waiting for something to tip it over. And what ended up happening, according to the traditional story, is that Siddhartha eventually got curious and he decided to go into the town. And when he went into the town, he saw four sights. And sometimes the story has him seeing the four sights at the same trip. Other times he took four separate trips and saw each of the four sites separately. But what basically happened is he went into the town and just to see what the world was like. And the first thing he saw was an old man. And I'll read from one account. And he's going through this town, you know, kind of taking a tour of the realm. And he's with a driver named Chana, sometimes described as his charioteer, but probably driving some sort of a cart. As the young prince was going through the streets, all of a sudden, from a small old hut beside the road, out came an old man with long silver-gray hair, wearing very old, torn, and dirty rags. The skin of his face was dried and wrinkled. His sunken eyes were dim, and he was almost blind. There were no teeth in his mouth. He stood up, trembling all over, almost bent over double and clutching at a shaking stick with two bent and skinny hands to save himself from falling. So Siddhartha saw this old man, and he asked his driver, he went, "What's that?" And he had never seen an old person before. And the driver told him, "Well, that's just someone who's gotten old. And that's just what happens." And Siddhartha said, "You mean my father's going to get like that?" And the driver said, "Yes." And he says, "I'm going to get like that?" The driver said, "Yes, even you will get old." And subsequently, they continued on, and subsequently, Siddhartha saw a sick man, a man who obviously had some sort of illness. And he had the same dialogue with his driver. The driver said, well, this is sickness. Sickness happens. And Siddhartha says, you mean I'm going to get sick? And the driver said, yes. It's a normal part of life. And then, still later, he saw a dead man, a corpse being prepared for the charnel ground. And again, he asked his driver, and his driver told him that is a dead person. And Siddhartha absolutely couldn't believe it. I'm going to die. My wife and family, they're all going to die. And it's just kind of an amazing thing, but he was kind of in this childlike bubble. And suddenly that bubble was burst by these first three sights. And when I was writing this talk, I reflected on something that happened when I was 5 years old. When I was five, my parents got divorced. And my mom took me and my brother into Manhattan, and that's where we were going to live. We were living in New Jersey, and then the divorce happened, and we moved to Manhattan. And we stayed at this really crummy hotel called the Ruxton Hotel. I still remember the name for some reason, the Ruxton Hotel. Really crummy hotel on 72nd Street on the west side. And I remember very vividly one day we were walking into the entrance of the hotel when I saw a man who was missing a leg. And there was just a stump. And he was on a cane. And he was walking through the hotel entrance. And I was totally stunned when this experience happened. It was like suddenly I couldn't believe that I was living in a world where there were people who didn't have legs, that was a possibility. And I was five. I had also been protected in the same way. Of course, when you're five, you tend to get protected from a lot of things. But when I think about this story of the Buddha, I think that it was a similar thing that happened to him, but he had been protected for a lot longer. But Siddhartha saw a fourth sight as well. And the fourth sight was the sight of a wandering ascetic, someone in robes with a begging bowl, who had gone forth into the homeless life to look for the answer to all the great dilemmas of human existence, birth and death, suffering. And so the fourth sight to Siddhartha was represented the possibility that you could actually leave home and discover the answer. That there was a path you could take that could lead to the truth. So really, and shortly thereafter that, Siddhartha left home. And 6 years later, he attained enlightenment and became the Buddha. But when he saw those four sights, the first three sights, what was really happening? What was really happening was he had his first experience of suffering. Very strong experience. And it's not just suffering, but he had an experience of what the Buddha later called the noble truth of suffering. It wasn't just suffering, it was the noble truth of suffering. I want to take just a little detour and talk about the difference between suffering and the noble truth of suffering. So there are two types of suffering. The first type of suffering is the type of suffering that we all know, the suffering where we are identified with our experience, where we are caught by the experience, where we're reacting constantly out of habit. This is the suffering that leads to more suffering. It's like we're on a treadmill, or we're caught in a maze and we can't get out. The second type of suffering is the suffering that leads to freedom. This is the suffering that includes awareness. So when we're aware that we're suffering, there's already something in our experience which is not suffering. The awareness of suffering itself is pointing to something that isn't caught, and it's pointing to the possibility of a way out, which is the inspiration for entering the path. So this is the suffering that leads to freedom, and this is it's often said that suffering gives rise to faith. And this is the sense of that, that this kind of suffering, conscious suffering, awareness of suffering, is actually something that can help us transform our experience of life. And this is why it's the noble truth of suffering. And so when the Buddha had this experience, that's what the kind of suffering he was experiencing. It was the noble truth of suffering, the first noble truth. So this archetypal story of the Buddha seeing these four sights resonates for us today in our lives. And really, I think of this as the four sights were represented the beginning of the Buddha's, Siddhartha's spiritual maturity. And I think that's really what the goal of a Dharma practice is. I mean, there's all sorts of things you can say. You know, it's to become enlightened. It's to become wiser, more compassionate. But really, the goal of the Dharma is to help us become completely mature human beings. So one aspect of this maturity is that we begin to see that our likes and dislikes are not the beginning and end of the world, that there's more to life than just our habits, that there's more to life than the things we want and the things we don't want, that there's more to life than being enchanted, being illusioned by life and by all the good things that we strive after. At least we think they're good. So the Buddha, after he saw these sights, reflected on their meaning in his life. And this is what came out of his reflection. He said, "Even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me, when an untaught, run-of-the-mill person, himself subject to aging, not beyond aging, sees another who is aged, he is horrified, humiliated, and disgusted, oblivious to himself that he too is subject to aging, not beyond aging. If I, who am subject to aging, not beyond aging, were to be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another person who is aged, that would not be fitting for me. As I notice this, the typical young person's intoxication with youth entirely dropped away." And then he goes on to reflect on illness, and he says the typical healthy person's intoxication with health dropped away, and the typical, you know, the living person's intoxication with life dropped away. So this is an important passage, and it's pointing, it's a good example of what I mean by spiritual maturity, because the Buddha isn't saying his enjoyment of health or life dropped away. He's saying his intoxication with health and life and youth dropped away. The intoxication is basically the sense that we own our health, our youth, and our life. That these things won't change. This is ours. That's what dropped away. So in a sense, we're all intoxicated by our habits. We're all enchanted by our likes and our dislikes. There's someone I know who's a really nice guy, professional, very solid person, who the other night, about 2 weeks ago, I think played 7 or 8 hours of a video game straight. So I don't know, some sort of zombie apocalypse video. And, you know, this stuff can be a lot of fun, but we get so plugged in that we actually kind of forget the urgency of that's really in life. So before Siddhartha saw the four sights, he was possessed by a certain heedlessness in life. And the word in Pali is pamada, heedlessness. But after he saw the four sights, he became possessed by another word called samvega. And this, in Pali, this means it's basically a sense of spiritual urgency. So his samvega, when he saw the four sights, Siddhartha's sense of spiritual urgency became very intense. And, you know, he ended up leaving his family because of it, because it was so intense. So I have a confession to make. I am not a spiritual genius the way the Buddha was. I'm not going to speak for anyone else here. I'm just for myself, I am not a spiritual genius. The Buddha needed to see the four sights just once. Just once, and that put him on the path. And 6 years later, he attained enlightenment, and we're sitting here today because of that. Most of us are not so lucky. We have to be reminded of the four sights over and over and over again. Our world doesn't encourage spiritual urgency. So we need to keep recognizing the urgency in our lives. We need to keep recognizing the divine messengers in our lives over and over again in whatever form they take, and really use them, because they're going to keep arising all the time, but use them as a way of contemplating the Dharma. And when we contemplate the Dharma, we don't have to go far. When the Buddha talked about mindfulness, he always talked about contemplating both internally and externally. So the Dharma, we are an expression of the Dharma. Things arise and pass away right here in this body and in our hearts and minds. So really, the divine messenger is anything that arouses your samvega, your spiritual urgency, anything that reminds you of the basic facts of human existence, the fact that things are impermanent, that there are unsatisfying in any lasting way, and that there's also there's a selflessness to life, which is also true. So what's your spiritual messenger in your life? It could be anything. There's a king, King Makadeva, renounced his throne and gave up all his possessions at the first appearance of a gray hare. So that became his spiritual messenger, his divine messenger. So at different times in our lives, we'll have different divine messengers. And right now for me, my divine messenger is my mother. She has been, over the last year, in a very steady state of decline. And there's been dementia, pretty strong dementia, and she's in a lot of denial about that, which has been very hard to work with her. And then a few months ago, she broke her spine because of osteoporosis, or just she has brittle bones. And so she's that's kind of healed, and she's still able to walk. But the point is, things are shutting down with her. And every time I talk to her, I don't know what mom is going to be on the other line. So in the Buddha's teaching of the five aggregates, you know, human experience consists of these five areas: form and feeling tone and perception and consciousness and mental formations, thoughts. That's it. That's what human beings are in terms of their experience. And in terms of my mom, I'm seeing these aggregates begin to fall apart. You know, her body is falling apart. And I'm seeing the result of very difficult feeling tone that she's experiencing. She's reacting to it. Her mind is falling apart. It's just like kind of unraveling. Her perceptions are all different than they've been. So I'm contemplating impermanence externally by trying to be a good son. And it's very difficult for me right now because I'm 3,000 miles away. She's in New York City. So, unlike the Buddha, most of us lose the path again and again and again. We lose the urgency. What was it? The fierce urgency of now, President Obama said. Well, that's definitely true about the path. So for us, what really behooves us is to keep reminding ourselves of the way that life, with all of its impermanence, keeps showing up for us, and to keep contemplating that and really taking it in, not ignoring it. Not ignoring it when we lose something or our body has a problem or gets ill. Really using the way life shows up normally just as a way of contemplating change, impermanence. And hopefully that will give us, that'll arouse the urgency to keep practicing. I'd like to end with a couple of quotes from Bhikkhu Bodhi. He says, "If the Dhamma is to be more than the bland, humdrum background of a comfortable life, if it is to become the inspiring, sometimes grating voice that steers us on to the great path of awakening, we ourselves must emulate the Bodhisattva in his process of maturation. We must join him on that journey outside the palace walls. And then finally, the divine messengers point to what lies beyond the transient, to a dimension of reality where there is no more aging, no more sickness, and no more death. This is the goal and final destination of the Buddhist path, Nibbana, the unaging, the unailing, the deathless. It is to direct us there that the divine messengers have appeared in our midst, and the good news of deliverance is their message. So that's all I've got on this subject today, but I'm certainly glad to answer any questions if we have time. So, thank you. Please.
I'm curious whether there's been a 17th heartbreak. And if so, whether it's been different or how you held up.
Yeah, actually, you know, that's a fantastic question. There was a 17th heartbreak, and I did something different during that heartbreak. It's kind of my habit, having heartbreaks, is to not see the person again, or to kind of shut myself off and not stay engaged. And for my 17th heartbreak, I'd been practicing, I guess, a number of years, and I decided, you know what, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to shut down, and I'm going to stay in touch with her. And I absolutely stayed her friend. And it's gone on for a number of years now, actually, that we've been friends. And the hardest thing about it is that every time I spoke to her, really that first year, my heart would break again just by speaking to her. But I decided that it was really important for me to stay with that grief, because there was something in that experience that was beneficial. And what I discovered is that the more I opened to my loss of that relationship, the more I began to see that the loss, the sadness, it was not my sadness. At a certain point, it ceased to be my sadness, and it simply became the sadness that's in the world. And when I understood that, the whole thing about losing a relationship, somehow everything was so much more workable. When I had the perspective of the world sadness, which is that we all experience sadness, this is a natural part of life. And then the other thing that happened during the 17th heartbreak is that because I was really practicing with the heartbreak, I also realized that there were a lot of other things that happened during the time that I was feeling heartbroken that were pleasant. So even though I was feeling heartbroken, there were good things happening too in my life. And I was in good moods at times. You know, a lot of times when we feel heartbroken, it's like we want to stay right there. And if we're not mindful, we will stay right there. But the mindfulness gives us this wider perspective. And you can't get so caught in the experience of heartbreak or whatever else it is that's challenging you, because you know there's more going on in your life than just the heartbreak. So that happened for me in that 17th heartbreak. And maybe that was the most valuable heartbreak I've had, because I really worked with it. Well, thank you for asking that.
Thank you.
Please.
Is that mindfulness the noble truth of suffering we're talking about?
Well, that's the Four Noble Truths. So mindfulness really ultimately includes the Four Noble Truths. So suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way leading to the end of suffering. But the first noble truth, which is really kind of what I was talking about today in terms of the Buddha's experience, is just the understanding that suffering exists, that there is suffering in the world. And most of the time, we tend to be wired in such a way that we're always trying to fix suffering, or always trying to deny it or put a Band-Aid on it, not see it, not experience it. But really, the way to freedom, the Buddha discovered that the way to freedom was to actually move into the suffering and begin to investigate it. So kind of a radical idea, actually, if you think about it. But please.
When I hear the word urgency, I always think of some deadline or goal that needs to be met in the future, which is a challenge for me being mindful, because then my mind goes towards the urgency of what's forward. How do you stay mindful with spiritual urgency, the fact that you need to be spiritual?
So it's a little bit the way I would describe the word effort in Buddhism. So it's often said that, you know, just be yourself, you don't have to do anything special, but you also need to make an effort. Like if when you're meditating, you actually have to show up and you actually have to become present and try to keep being present, and that involves a certain amount of effort. So I would say it's good to make a relaxed effort. So I would say the same thing about urgency. The urgency is just a reminder to keep practicing. It doesn't need to be over the top. And definitely don't beat yourself up about, oh my God, I just discovered I haven't been urgent the last 2 hours. Really be kind to yourself. But the urgency is just a reminder to practice.
Great. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Do we have announcements?
Hey, Tom, I have one, too.
Oh, yes, please, go ahead.
Oh, just a very quick announcement. So I am teaching an 8-week course in mindfulness-based stress reduction starting in the fall in the Mission District, and I've got some postcards here if you'd like to take some. So,
I've just been informed that there are two spaces left in our annual retreat, which is the fourth weekend in September at Vajrapani Institute. So if you're interested in going, now would be a really good time to register with Jerry Jones there. And there are flyers out on the table, and feel free to ask me if you have any questions. Thanks.
Jerry.
Hi. Thanks, Phil, for coming today. It was great.
Yeah, pleasure.
Next week, our speaker will be, his name is Dale Borglum, and he is the founder and executive director of the Living Dying Project. So, interesting.
Yes, Jim.
Yeah, on Sunday morning, the 26th, we're going to have an all-sangha meeting here, and thanks will be given to people who have been in service. We will expose the inner workings of the GDF. It will be an 8-week study program. So at the same time, you know, we're working on a plan, and they've been very special in the past.
Michael.
GBF continues to look for a replacement treasurer for the Great Gag Intendant for like years and years and years. In order to do this, it would really be helpful if somebody who knows not Excel,
QuickBooks.
Somebody who knows QuickBooks could come up, because it has to be moved from QuickBooks to whoever the next treasurer is. So if anybody can do that, please let me know.
We have a prospect.
But that doesn't mean anyone else can't sit.
That's right.
Prospect is only prospect.
Any other announcements? Okay, so I'd like to invite you to make our new guests feel welcome. Gary, Patrick, Adam, and Augusta, did you raise your hand?
I was here once before.
Okay. Wonderful. Let's gather in a circle for identification of merit.
Yes. I'm Oates.
Oh!
So when you're in the retreats, and if you drink any of the tea, you can just place your cup in soapy water. I'm going to try to conserve water, but I'll wash all the cups at the end. I'll be coming around with the Donna bowls, so this will be an opportunity to be mindful with generosity. And at the end, for those of you that would like to become introduced to some of the members, we tend to go to lunch, meeting out in front about 12:30, and there's a sign-up if you want to get on to our newsletter.
Oh, thank you for reminding me.
I put a pad of paper out there. There's a list that you'll see. If you would like to get off the physical mailing list to help save us postage for our bi-monthly newsletter and just receive it online, or pick it up here, if you can quite frequently, we encourage you to pick it up instead of it being mailed out. That list is out there, so please feel free to add your name. By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.